In a quick word of prayer, we'll get started. Father, in Jesus' precious name, we just thank you for all the hard work that went into putting together this conference and for all the people who are setting aside important time to be here and to study about you and about your creation. And so I pray, Lord, that you would anoint me to proclaim your truth so that I would not lead anyone astray, and I would just plant a little seed and do a little bit of good and just offer something to this conference. And so I just pray that you just bless everyone here, Lord. For those who know you, you just bring them closer to you. And for those that may not know you, I just pray, Lord, that you would just gently speak to their hearts. In Jesus' precious name we pray. Amen. Okay, so this deals more with what philosophers call ethics, issues of morality. And we're seeing a big transition right now in America, a transition that's been taking place in Europe for decades. And it's a transition in the way we think of right and wrong. Okay? And I think that it's directly tied in to Darwinian evolution. I'm going to try to make the case for that. With some of these, some of the thinkers I'm going to refer to, I'm going to give some quotes from some of their writings. Not as many as I would like, but we just, you know, we have limited time. And to see that I'm not making this up. This is what Darwin said. This is what Peter Singer is now saying, an ethicist from Princeton. Now, with traditional morality, okay, it was, you know, it's spelled out real clearly by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. And the unfortunate thing was even our founding fathers were not able to be as consistent with these principles that they spelled out. Not all the founding fathers were Bible-believing Christians, okay? Many of them were, but some were deists, but they were, the American deists tended to be, like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, pro-Christian deists. They thought Christianity was good for society and for keeping order and for progress. Whereas the French deists, the Jacobins, were very anti-Christian deists. They believed in, you know, bulldozing churches and things of that sort. But the Founding Fathers held to the biblical view of government and the biblical view of morality. And so Thomas Jefferson states, and it was signed, as you know, by the signers of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. Okay? And from this, there was the belief that God had given inalienable rights to human beings, because they're human beings, rights that cannot be taken away. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay? And so this was what our traditional morality in America is based upon. So even often you will find people who are not Christians, and they will still hold to this type of morality. But with evolution, you get a different worldview and you get different morality. With evolution, you get the survival of the fittest mentality. As far as I know, no evolutionist would argue that all men have evolved equally. Okay? This whole idea of equal rights for human beings, that is a biblical Judeo-Christian idea. Okay, now I am glad that most evolutionists I know promote human rights to one degree or another. But I would argue that's more because of their Christian upbringing or being brought up in a country that was so influenced by the Christian worldview. It does not follow from survival of the fittest and natural selection. So if no evolutionist would argue that all men have evolved equally, what does this do to inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Now, some excellent books showing the link between evolution and genocide and the eugenics movement, what some would call the culture of death. Richard Weikart's work, From Darwin to Hitler, he was interviewed in the Expelled movie with Ben Stein. Very interesting book, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World by Benjamin Weicker. And then Consumers, a very scary book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World by Wesley J. Smith, who works with the Discovery Institute, showing where some of the world's leading scientists want to take us in the future. And it's not Kansas. So we'll start out with, you know, if you want, you know, the thing is, so often people say, well, Christianity's intolerant. There were two Christian guys in a bar in Alabama, and they beat up a homosexual guy or something like that. And it's like, that doesn't represent Christianity. You know, and if the guys are Christian, what are they doing in a bar in Alabama starting fights? I mean, it's just like, so we got to be careful about this. If you want to say, well, what does Christianity teach? Go to the teachings of Jesus. Okay? So if people in the name of Christianity kill Jewish people, I don't know about you, but I do know about most of you, but I worship a Jew. Jesus is Jewish. The Bible is written by Jews. The early church was Jewish. So when you get people in the name of Christianity being anti-Semitic, that's contrary to the teachings of the founder. So you go back to the founders, and that's where you find this is what this school of thought teaches. And so that's why I would go to Charles Darwin and see what he said. Okay? And Charles Darwin reluctantly admitted some of these things. In his Origin of Species, 1859, his most famous work, Darwin argued for a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life and new life forms. He tried to explain our origins without reference to God. Okay, so his work made God, in the minds of many educated people, made belief in God obsolete. Okay, we don't have to know the who, because now we know the how. We got to know how everything got here. In reality, evolutionists really don't know the how. You say, well, how did everything come about? Evolution. Well, how did that come about? I don't know. Maybe mutations. Well, no, mutations garble the already existing genetic code. It doesn't add any new genetic information. You need new genetic information. Well, we don't know how it occurred, but it occurred. Well, then you don't know the how. And so if you don't know the how, maybe you ought to go back to the who. Okay? But whatever the case, he's trying to say we don't need to believe in the who, God, because now we figured out the how. And so he rejected all supernatural causes and only accepted natural causes. Now that really hurts when it comes to Big Bang cosmology. Most of the world's leading scientists embrace the Big Bang model, and it shows that all of nature had a beginning. So you ran out of natural causes. So you either got to believe it just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause, or whatever caused it to exist must, by definition, transcend nature, i.e. must be a supernatural cause. But that was another 60 years after Darwin, with Hubble and the expansion of the universe and the Big Bang cosmology. A lot of people don't know about another book by Darwin, The Descent of Man, that he wrote in 1871. In this work, Darwin attempted to apply his evolutionary theories to moral issues. In other words, he's trying to answer the question, now that evolution is true, how should man live? Okay? If God didn't create us and didn't create the universe, what difference does that make for the way we live our lives? Now, he was kind of reluctant about this. He didn't really, because here was a guy who thought slavery was bad, but he probably got that because Great Britain was influenced by the Christian worldview. It doesn't really fit with his statements in The Descent of Man and what logically follows from his evolutionary views. Okay, it was actually his cousin, we'll talk about him in just a minute, Francis Galton, that beat him to the punch and started bringing out the ethical implications of Darwinian evolution. And then it was kind of like, well, I'm the guy who's the king of the hill, I might as well put my two cents in there too. And it was kind of like a little competition, but they were friends, and Darwin respected Galton's work and vice versa. Here's a quote from page 403 of Darwin's The Descent of Man. Man, like every other animal, has no doubt advanced to his present high condition through a struggle for existence consequent on his rapid multiplication. There should be open competition for all men, and the most able should not be prevented by laws or customs from succeeding best and rearing the largest number of offspring. Okay? So he's saying you shouldn't be prevented by law, whether it's laws against polygamy or laws, you know, don't prohibit the most able of our species from reproducing as much as possible. We want our better humans to produce more offspring. Okay? Page 168. But excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. And Darwin he talks about how we really don't make sense. We really don't get the bigger picture when we build asylums and hospitals and things of that sort. There were even some of the early evolutionists who were Haeckel in Germany was originally a pacifist before World War I, but he was a pacifist. He was against war because who do you send into battle? Both sides send their strongest and most ablest men. And so Haeckel's problem wasn't that we're killing humans, we're killing the best. We're killing the most able, the most fit. Okay? Darwin said this, at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace throughout the world the savage races. Okay? And you see Darwin regularly pushing things off into the future because he doesn't even like the consequences of his worldview, but he's honest enough to admit them. Francis Galton was much more enthusiastic about this. And so what you see, Darwin's views from the descent of man, weaker members either should not be allowed to reproduce, or at the very least, natural selection teaches that the most able of a species should reproduce at a much quicker rate than the weaker members. Okay? He also believed white Europeans were superior to primitive tribal peoples. Okay, what you find in the early Darwinists, if you're British, the British are kind of the top. They're among the white Europeans, and they're kind of superior, but the British are among the top. When you get to Haeckel and the Germans, it's always the Germans, you know? So I wish that there were tribal guys who had been trained in early evolutionary thought, so there would be some of these guys arguing that their tribe is the superior. They're the top of the food chain. Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, he founded the modern eugenics movement. He coined the word eugenics, which means good genes or good birth. And he got his idea about eugenics from reading Darwin's Origin of Species. Now, he wrote his book, Hereditary Genius, in 1869, where he introduced the term eugenics even before Darwin did. And then he wrote about it, but he had written about it earlier in 1865, and he argued that natural selection demands eugenics. With eugenics, you don't want the weaker members of your species to reproduce. Okay? So this talks about sterilization and then encouraging others to reproduce. The way Hitler, who was not an atheist, but he did hold to Darwinian evolution, he blended that with German pantheism. Okay? But the way Hitler spelled this out single German ladies in their late 20s, early 30s, they weren't married yet, they were encouraged to have sexual relations with single German males of the Aryan type that were considered, you know, the most able to reproduce babies, and then these babies were raised in hospitals. In fact, I don't know if it was Learning Channel, Discovery Channel actually showed video footage of these poor babies. Some of them are probably still alive today. A lot of them died younger. They didn't get that nurture from a mom. But this guy got the ball rolling. It's not like he knew something Darwin didn't know, but he was just more enthusiastic about it than Darwin does. Darwin had kind of a little bit of a Christian conscience to him on some of these matters. Herbert Spencer, another thinker, that after Darwin wrote his Origin of Species, Spencer removed God from his ethical theories. So he used to have a more traditional view of ethics, where God was kind of the foundation of it. And now he attempted to build his new ethical theory on evolutionary thought. So this is not me just spouting a bunch of weird stuff. When you get the atheistic evolutionary worldview, implies a different set of moral laws, moral principles than does the Christian worldview, or at least the theistic worldview, belief in a personal God. Ernst Haeckel in Germany, 19th century German Darwinist, he believed Darwinian thought ruled out human free will and that morality is evolving and not fixed, and he saw natural selection as the driving force for morality. So basically, I'm just telling you that these early Darwinian evolutionists, they saw that not only do you need a different science, not only do you need a different worldview, but that's also going to entail questioning the traditional worldview handed down to us by Christians. And Haeckel's famous for the embryos and the different paintings of the embryo, and that's all been disproven. A friend of mine, Jonathan Wells, his son was one of my former students. But Jonathan Wells was also in Ben Stein's movie, Expelled. And but in his work, Icons of Evolution, he shows all the artistic imagination that went into those drawings, and that it's pretty much a house of cards, but it still shows up in scientific textbooks, be they high school or college textbooks. And if the world's leading atheists no longer hold to that, it should be removed. Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche's an interesting guy here because technically he's not really a Darwinian evolutionist. He is an atheistic evolutionist, but in his writings at times he will talk about problems he has with Darwin's theories. So that's very important for us to take note of, okay? Because a lot of people will say, no, you got to exempt Nietzsche from the Nazis and what they did, and from Stalin and Lenin and what they did, because after all, Nietzsche had problem with Darwinian evolution as well. But you got to understand what his problems were. He's a German philosopher, embraced atheistic evolution. He said, God is dead. We now have reached a level of learning where we realize belief in God is obsolete, no longer a viable force in the thought of Western civilization. So God is dead, Christianity is dead, so truth and traditional morality have died with them. And Christianity is holding back human progress and human evolution. And so he rejected the soft values of Christianity, like kindness and love and grace, and he promoted the hard values of the overman or the superman, basically the guys with the courage through their will to power to create their own morality, to create their own truth, to force it down everybody else's throat with a vengeance, and to basically force man into the next stage in the spiritual and biological evolution of mankind. So Nietzsche rejected Darwin's view of natural selection and survival of the fittest. Nietzsche's will to power was even more aggressive than Darwin's will to survive. Okay? See, with Darwin, the strong compete with the weak for survival. It's like if we don't have enough food, the strong and the weak are going to be competing. The strong are going to have to eliminate the weak, but it's all about survival. It's not about survival with Nietzsche. It's about thriving, okay? It's about dominance, not survival. With Nietzsche, the strong aggressively dominate the weak, or at least should aggressively dominate the weak, and that's what he did not like about Christianity. It spent too much time being kind to the weak and trying to help the weak. And it's like, look, we've got to further the progress of human evolution. So forget about mercy. Forget about grace. We've got to have this group of supermen or overmen with, through their will to power, their lust to power, with the courage to create their own values and move mankind forward. He predicted the 20th century was going to be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind because it was going to be an atheistic world come of age, applying its atheism. But he thought out of that would come the Superman. Now, another difference between Nietzsche and Darwin, the superiority was based on biology, okay? With Nietzsche, even though he believes in biological evolution, the superiority was more based on ideology or intellect. So his supermen were more the thinkers like him, the atheistic thinkers like him. And I actually think that we're moving away from a Darwinian evolutionary ethic, because right now it's not politically correct to be a racist. Okay? And so I think we're actually moving towards a more ideologically driven survival of the fittest. In fact, we're moving from survival of the fittest to Nietzsche's will to power. Lenin, Joseph Stalin, Marxist atheists who embraced Darwinian evolution. Of course, they embraced Karl Marx and his view of dialectical materialism and economic factors and all this other stuff, and the workers of the world needing to unite and revolt. But when it came to ethics, they rejected absolute morality and promoted revolution. And Lenin and Stalin together slaughtered over 20 million people in the Soviet Union. Now we've got to, there have been people in the name of Christianity that have slaughtered tens of thousands over periods of hundreds of years. But atheistic evolution, when applied to governments, that hasn't been around a long time. But whenever it's been around, the results have been pretty ugly. And so you just go from 1917 with the start of the Soviet Union to the present day, and we have seen literally hundreds of millions of people slaughtered. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Chinese communism, based on atheistic evolution and survival of the fittest mentality, responsible for up to about 65 million deaths. Steve Kartois's book, Black Book of Communism, states that atheistic communism throughout the world may have murdered close to 100 million people in the 20th century alone. I actually think his numbers are too conservative. R.J. Rummel has a work, I know he coined the word democide, which means death by government, and he says that from 1917 to 1991, the years of his research, that somewhere between 170 million and 320 million people were killed by their governments during that time, okay? Now, you can say, well, why the big gap between 170 million and 320 million? Well, you don't just walk up to the communist leaders and say, could you show me the accurate files that you kept and the records on all the people you murdered, you know? So you have to go to a village, and if there's good eyewitnesses that, yeah, we saw this guy taken to prison, and we knew when... We can tell you the day when he was executed, that's one of the 170,000. But the higher number represents the guys who just, you know, spoke in the name of freedom, spoke out against Stalin or Lenin or Mao, and just disappeared. And so they're not quite sure. They haven't found bodies or enough data. So, but whatever the case, and this is a lesson Americans have not learned. Even Christian Americans have not learned. Let me tell you something. We are in dangerous ground when we believe our leaders on both sides of the aisle, when they tell us that terrorism is the biggest threat to our physical well-being. Terrorism is not the biggest threat. War is an even bigger threat. But even war is not the biggest threat. Big government in the 20th century alone has slaughtered more of its own people during peacetime than all the people that have died in the history of mankind's wars put together. So the most efficient killing machine known to man is government. That's why George Washington referred to government as a lesser evil, okay? And that's why our founding fathers wanted government leaders to be limited in their power. So actually, if we thought like the founding fathers thought, we would not be willing to give up freedom in return for security. In fact, Ben Franklin said, any people are willing to give up liberty for security deserve neither, okay? And so but whatever the case... atheistic communism has been the source of at least close to 100 million people in the 20th century alone. And we have Adolf Hitler. Hitler embraced Darwinian evolution, but, you know, Christians constantly call Hitler an atheist. He was not an atheist. Atheists often call Hitler a Christian because he was baptized as a Roman Catholic. I was baptized as a Roman Catholic. That doesn't make me Roman Catholic today. I pastor a non-denominational church, okay? But Hitler, when you really study him, Richard Terrell's book, Resurrecting the Third Reich, an outstanding book written by a philosopher. He shows the occultic roots, and there are numerous scholarly works that show the occultic roots of Hitler's thought. But he did combine his paganism with Darwinian evolution. In fact, I think that's what is much more dangerous than atheism. Then atheism as a worldview is actually a neo-pagan worldview that takes some of the survival of the fittest Darwinian evolutionary principles and combines that with pantheism, with a religious belief that man is God. And that's the Nazis killed less than the Soviet Union, but keep in mind they had a lot less time. And it seems to me, too, that the movers and the shakers, the proponents of world government today, seem to be more from the neo-pagan side of the aisle, which would be more akin to the Nazis than they would be to the Soviet Union-style genocide. But whatever the case, Hitler's views led to the slaughter of 6 million Jews. He may have murdered up to 20 million people total. Okay? And again, he was a neo-pagan, but he did embrace... In fact, let me go back a couple slides. He believed that the Aryan race was the master race and non-Aryans were subhumans. His Mein Kampf, which he wrote in prison, My Struggle, that's the reason why many Germans identified with him. After World War I, they were economically bankrupt, and Hitler was saying, my struggle is the German people's struggle, and I want to fight this. And I want to restore German pride. I want to get our economy back on track. I want to build our military. I don't care what the Allies say. But in his Mein Kampf, he argues that the master race was the Aryan race, and he wanted to exterminate non-Aryans so that they would not pollute the pure bloodline of the master race. So he accepted Darwinian eugenic theories. Okay? Ernst Haeckel had a big influence on his thought in that area. But then he combined that with his neo-paganism, and I think that's what makes such a horrific mix. Now, Margaret Sanger, so we saw it, England and Germany, but the eugenic ideas, the eugenic implications, the moral, ethical implications of Darwinian evolution or some form of atheistic evolution even came across the sea to America. Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, she wrote The Pivot of Civilization in 1922, where she called for the immediate sterilization of feeble-minded people. Okay, she was the foremost leader of the eugenics movement in America. She even at times spoke highly of Adolf Hitler before we started fully seeing what he was doing. Okay. And then it was politically incorrect to back Hitler, and so Planned Parenthood toned down its rhetoric once the Nazi atrocities became known. Margaret Sanger promoted sexual promiscuity, birth control, sterilization for impoverished people, mainly non-whites. She looked at most poor people were either black or darker Europeans than the white Europeans, and, you know... when the blacks were coming out of slavery not too long before. So it was prejudice against them, which was holding them back. And then the darker Europeans, they were the newest immigrants in town, whether they be Spanish, Italians, or whatever. They were the new, and whoever the new kids are on the block, and they don't speak English. You know, my grandpa Fernandez came over in 1917 and sent for his wife 2 years later from Portugal. So... he struggled. I mean, he was a carpenter, but if he couldn't find, he had to raise 13 kids during the Depression. Okay, so if he couldn't find work in carpentry, he bootlegged whiskey. Okay, but he did whatever he had to do to keep his family alive. So the Fernandezes didn't prosper until his boys, after getting out of World War II, got good jobs and worked hard, and then were able to pass on the fruit of their labor to their kids. The Italian side of my family came over in 1903. They came over as children, the Menichinos and the Restainos. And so whenever the newer people come in, they've got to learn the language. That first generation is always going to be tough. She thought, no, they're inferior to the Caucasians, And we need to sterilize them for evolutionary reasons and survival of the fittest. And then she also promoted abortion and euthanasia. Of course, she was considered rather radical back then. She stated the most, this is in her work, Woman and the New Race, page 67, the most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it. Okay? Now, this was something that blew me away. Forced sterilization in America from 1907 to the early 1970s. So I was like 12, 13, 14 years old when we put a stop to this. Okay? But from 1907 to the early 1970s, nearly 70,000 Americans had been forced to have legally sanctioned sterilization operations. Okay? In fact, I believe it was the Clinton administration where he appointed some guy for some big position, nominated him for it, and they found out that in the 1970s, this doctor had been part of government-run sterilization, and so the guy just dropped out. And that was probably it for his political career. So we bought into this, this idea of eugenics. You know, Darwinian evolution was kind of the rage of the day, and even we bought into it over here in America. B.F. Skinner, founder of behavioral science, in his work, Beyond Freedom and Human Dignity, he argues that due to atheistic evolution, we need to acknowledge that man is not free. He is biologically determined. We don't have a soul. We don't have free will. Our actions are biologically determined. Man's actions are the products of his environment and his genes, period. Okay? So Skinner argued that the intellectual elite, him and his buddies, need to control man genetically through, you know, genetic surgery, whatever it may be, genetic manipulation, maybe some cloning. But the intellectual elite need to control man genetically and environmentally to bring about the best future. Okay? Now, Francis Schaeffer responded at in the 1970s with his work, Back to Freedom and Human Dignity. Powerful little book. And he pointed out the two fallacies with that. When you look at that last sentence down there, okay, the two key words are intellectual and best. Okay? If man's actions, and Skinner would even argue man's ideas are the product of his environment and his genes, then what in the world is an intellectual? If I say, me no like cheese, okay? That's as intellectual as E equals MC squared, if Skinner is right. Because it's just as biologically determined. Einstein's not free, Skinner's not free. Okay? And then his thought, he rules out absolute universal morality. So there really is no such thing as good and evil. Well, there's no such thing as good, then there's no such thing as better or best. So what in the world does he mean by the best future? If the whole world blows up tomorrow, why is that bad? If there's no such thing as good and bad, there is no best future. Okay, so it's actually a self-refuting system. Yet B.F. Skinner's thought, his behavioral theories, are behind UNESCO, the United Nations. They're the education division of UNESCO, and then we apply it here in America. Goals 2000, America 2000. We think he's got the whole thing right. Watson and Crick behind them. You got the double helix from the DNA. They won the Nobel Prize for discovering the DNA double helix. They believe in infanticide. They've given speeches, and I believe in the 1970s where they said they believe in infanticide. It's the killing of babies already born. Infanticide of disabled babies up to 3 days old. Okay, so basically they say, look, since we're killing babies before they're born, and by the way, let me tell you something. The world's leading experts, pro-abortion experts, that are, you know, genetic experts, okay, they acknowledge that life starts at conception. If it's dog life starts at conception. If it's human life, human life starts at conception. So people like Peter Singer out of Princeton acknowledges that we are killing human beings when we abort a baby. He says the pro-lifers are right on that. The anti-abortionists are right on that. But he's pro-abortion, so he says, so basically he's saying there's got to be a level of consciousness and personhood before you have any supposed right to life. You see, once God is taken out of the equation, we don't, as human beings, we don't have an inalienable right to life. So we got to arbitrarily draw the line somewhere else. And Singer used to say 14 days after birth, maybe a month after birth. And his colleague said setting a limit is inconsistent with our thoughts. So basically, you know, anybody that doesn't achieve the proper level of personhood, whether they're elderly, whether they're a baby, whether they're disabled, if their loved ones don't want them and don't want the expenses, Peter Singer thinks they should be able to dispose of them. So Watson and Crick argued, genetic experts, and they argued, look, we're killing babies before they're born. We're playing God. So why not just, in fact, the way they put it back in the 70s was, why not just declare the baby human until the third day, and then the parents and the doctors can look at the baby and decide if they want to bring this baby, quote unquote, into life. But they promoted genetic engineering, things such as cloning to produce perfect humans. They were calling for this. Peter Singer out of Princeton, the ethicist who teaches at Princeton University, he's an evolutionist. He believes that the pro-lifers are right. Human life starts at conception. Still, he's pro-abortion. In his book, Practical Ethics, he promotes abortion, infanticide, that's the killing of babies already born, and euthanasia for humans who do not achieve personhood, a certain level of consciousness. He believes the life of a newborn human baby is not worth as much as the life of a full-grown pig, dog, or chimpanzee, because the newborn baby does not have the same level of consciousness. Here's the way he says it. Tough to break him down, but by the way, almost every other page, he has to differentiate between his views and what the Nazis taught. I told my students, if I had to do that every other day, what would you think? They'd say, well, we'd think that your views must be close to the Nazis if you have to keep splitting hairs for us. And so I said, bingo, that's what's going on with Singer. So I have argued that the life of a fetus, and even more plainly of an embryo, is of no greater value than the life of a non-human animal at a similar level of rationality, self-consciousness, awareness, capacity to feel, etc. And that since no fetus is a person, no fetus has the same claim to life as a person. So you can be a human, a fetus is a human, a living human, but it's not a person until it achieves a certain level of self-consciousness, according to Singer. Now, it must be admitted that these arguments apply to the newborn baby as much as to the fetus. So what he's saying is, look, if we legalize abortion, we should legalize the killing of disabled babies. And the life of a newborn baby is of less value to it than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee is to the non-human animal. In other words, the pig, the dog, the chimpanzee, if it's at a later stage, it values its own life more than a fetus, which hasn't reached the level of self-consciousness, so it doesn't value its own life. Therefore, we shouldn't value it. And it goes right back up as of no greater value than the life of a non-human animal at a similar level of rationality. Okay, he's also kind of the father of the modern animal rights movement. Okay, so this goes hand in hand. Okay. And he's not really promoting animals to the level of humans. He's demoting humans to the level of animals. Joseph Fletcher was the founder of situational ethics, another former Princeton professor. He promoted government action to force eugenics on the weak, and he wanted to set a legal minimal standard for allowing humans to reproduce. Okay? He promoted genetic engineering, human cloning, animal-human hybrids to achieve the goal of producing what he referred to as superior people. He called for human-animal chimeras to be some sort of slave labor, okay? But he's kind of, just if you get a chance and you really want to get depressed, just go to do a search on transhumanism, okay? The debate You know, a really good book, though, is that Wesley J. Smith, The Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, because there he just gives you an overview of it. He gives you the quotes of all these guys and things of that sort. But transhumanism, they want to bring about the next stage in the evolution of mankind. They believe that things have been randomly happening. So when Dr. DeYoung was up here showing all this evidence of design, they think, well, that design just randomly happened. But now humans are at the point where we figured out the design that accidentally happened, and now we can actually intellectually design our own species to go further. And so they're calling for transhumanism. They want to transcend humanity. And there's different ways of doing it, through human cloning, genetic engineering, but one of the ways is through animal-human hybrids. And at Ivy League schools today, the main debate is not about whether or not we should do this. You know, because it's Christians, it's the Christian worldview that tells scientists just because we can do something doesn't mean we should. Okay? That boundary is a lot easier to pass if you take God out of the equation, you take morality out of the equation, and we often do things just because we can. Okay? And so basically the debate is not should we have animal-human hybrids in the future. The debate is about whether or not we should produce the animal-human hybrids to be, you know, our warriors, so we don't have to go to war. We can just send, you know, lion-human hybrids or whatever to war. Or our slave labor, for purposes of slave labor, like Fletcher wants, or should they be the master race and we be their slaves? Now, of course, the Fletchers and the Singers would be, you know, on top of them. They'd be the top echelon. But whatever the case, you see, when man takes God out of the universe, man inevitably begins to play God. And just the culture of death that thinks we need to kill innocent human beings because they don't meet our standard of what a superior human being is or an able-minded human being is, that same culture of death that wants to kill these over here also wants to get in, not only in the business of destruction, but they also want to get in the business of creation. Now, I thought, before I came up here to talk, I thought, what kind of argument am I making? I'm really not even making an argument. Singer, Fletcher, Darwin, Nietzsche, they're making the argument for me. I'm just telling you what they said and why they said it. Okay? And then there's Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins says that believing in God is like believing in the flying spaghetti monster. I don't think that's a good analogy, because he's made millions of dollars arguing and writing against God. He hasn't made a dime debating anybody or speaking anywhere trying to refute the existence of the flying spaghetti monster. So I just don't see, you know, if about 90% of people on the planet Earth believe in God and zero believe in the flying spaghetti monster, I just think that's a really bad analogy. My question for Dawkins is, if you don't believe God exists, why do you hate him with so much passion? You read his book, The God Delusion, you got to get 150 pages before you even find any argumentation at all. It's a tantrum in print. Okay? The atheist that I've debated over the years, I'm not famous enough to debate a Dawkins. It costs a lot of money to bring him in. Why would they bring in an unknown apologist named Fernandez? So they're going to spend the money on Dawkins. They're going to bring in a big gun on the other side as well. But the atheists that I've debated don't even like Dawkins. They think he's an embarrassment to them because there's too much attacking the man going on. The atheists that I've debated, like Michael Martin, philosophy professor from Boston University, debated him back in 1997. Now, he's up in years now. But these guys were much more rational. Whether you agreed with them or not, you had 500 pages of rational, philosophical, scientific argumentation to deal with. Okay? I think what makes the new atheist the new atheist is about, I got it about that in my book, write about it in The Atheist Delusion, Christian Response to Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. What makes them the new atheist is their lack of patience. It's like they're saying, look, We know that Christianity and these other religions, we know belief in God is obsolete. We know it's the cause of all the world's problems. I disagree with that. Okay, Hitchens and Dawkins, atheistic communists, they say, well, that's because they were religious atheists. They're not the nice atheists. Like, well, then why can't we do that and say, well, yeah, when the Catholic Church put to death heretics, those were a different kind of Christian than I am. I'm the kind of Christian who goes by the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of Jesus. They say, no, you're all Christians, you're all grouped together. But they don't want to group all atheists together. Because if they group all atheists together, then they got like 100 million innocent humans dead. And then you throw in the neo-pagan Darwinians, and you get a few dozen more million deaths. But Richard Dawkins, In the Name of Tolerance, page 303 of his The God Delusion, he calls teaching children about God child abuse. Now, I think that Richard Dawkins wants to see child abusers in prison. Okay? So I don't know. Is he calling for the closing of churches, Christian schools, and imprisoning Christians? I mean, if I were a child abuser, I would expect Richard Dawkins to want me to go to prison. But I'm not a child abuser because I teach high school kids about God. But he thinks I am. So what's coming down here? And with the new atheists, I think that's what we have. Is this point where they're acting like, look, we've disproven God, let's try to pretend, let's stop pretending that Christianity is a viable option or Judaism or whatever it may be. It's the cause of all our problems anyway. It is time to now to start clamping down on this stuff. Okay? And with what was said all leading up to this, with the eugenics, with sterilization, with abortion, with infanticide, with euthanasia. By the way, Wesley J. Smith, in his work, The Culture of Death, he documents, even before Terry Schiavo, since the early 1990s, we've been euthanizing innocent human beings, many of whom were not even dying. They were just in a comatose state. And it wasn't even any change of laws. Usually it's the family or the doctors going to a court, to a judge, to get a court order, a court ruling, and then you can pull the plug on Aunt Ethel. That's been going on in America since the 1990s. I just want to close with a few points here. These are just overviews of other talks that I've given on this topic. But if you look at Romans 1, 18 through 32, Dr. DeYoung referred to Romans 1 in his talk about God, evidence of God in creation. But Paul tells us man suppresses that truth. So the first stage in the decay in human civilization, and I think this applies to any culture, is the rejection of God. When you reject God, you got to replace that. You end up being an idolater. All atheism is a halfway house between belief in God and paganism or idolatry. Okay, we find, I mean, it's the reason why Carl Sagan capitalized the Sea of Cosmos and started speaking about the cosmos, the universe, as if it had intelligence and things of that sort. You end up finding the same religious passion you find with Christians, you find that among atheists. And so basically what ends up happening, atheism becomes a religion. And eventually it just, Jesus said man does not live on bread alone. We're more than physical beings, whether the atheists like it or not, we're also spiritual beings. We have spiritual thirst for something more. And so eventually atheism just doesn't last. It didn't last long in ancient Greece. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle shot that down. And it's not going to last too much longer here. And so we're seeing a secular America and secular Europe that is now going neo-pagan and New Age. Okay? But the rejection of God will lead to idolatry, immorality, widespread wickedness, and violence. But the final stage is the promotion of evil, the new absolutes, and the new tolerance, and we'll talk about those a little bit. So it's basically what we call political correctness, where all of a sudden, like Isaiah said in Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good, call good evil and evil good. See, in William Watkins' books, The New Absolutes, he gives you the old absolute, and then he gives you what the new absolutes are, okay, and shows how our culture has changed. See, we started out with God's moral absolutes, Declaration of Independence, biblical morality. Then we moved into a stage of no absolutes, moral relativism. What's right for you is right for you, doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. So your friends would say, oh, you're a Christian? Well, I'm glad. That's good for you, but it doesn't work for me. But I'm happy for you. Now it's getting to the point, you're a Christian? You're one of those bigots? So all of a sudden, what was traditionally viewed as being an evil lifestyle is now promoted, and you can have marches in support of that lifestyle. Whereas if you tell people you're a Christian, watch out. One of my former students, his first class in an eco-psychology course, whatever that means, the teacher asked, are there any Christians in the room? And there were several Christians, but he was the only one courageous enough to raise his hand. He's the nicest guy in the world. He's shorter than me, and I'm not real tall. Okay, I only go about, what, 6'1", 6'2"? Give or take a foot. But a little guy, really, real pound for pound, tough guy, but the nicest guy on the planet, courteous and encouraging everybody. And this teacher just tore into him in front of the other students for the rest of the class. And he had to text his mom. He was hurting so bad and stuff like that. And then the other Christians said, we were there with you, man. No, you weren't. No, you weren't with them, man. So now we have the new morality. Christian morality has been replaced by evolutionary pagan immorality. And Isaiah says that final stage, that stage of political correctness, new morality, and new tolerance, that's the stage where culture is just, is this close to being judged. Josh McDowell and Bob Hostetler, their work, the new tolerance, traditional tolerance meant freedom of speech, freedom of religion. But the new tolerance is this: all beliefs are equally true and all behavior is equally wholesome. Oh, by the way, if you disagree with us, we can't tolerate you. So it's kind of, what have we traditionally called it when you can only tolerate people who agree with you? That's intolerance and bigotry, yeah. And now, so intolerance has now been promoted to tolerance. And then those are, if my neighbor is a Muslim, I don't want to see him in prison. If he doesn't break the law, and I'll argue with him. If you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. He'll argue with me. If you don't submit to Allah, you're going to hell. And then if he wants to have spaghetti at my house or, have dinner in my house, he can have dinner in my house. I'll have dinner at his house. He's not going to get me to go fishing with him because I don't like to fish. I'm a city guy, but maybe we'll go to a ball game or something. But the fact of the matter is I'm tolerant of him. But it's freedom of speech, freedom of religion. We're free to disagree. But the new tolerance says, no, we can put you in prison for your beliefs. I'm not an atheist. I'm not a Muslim. I don't want to see I will stand up for the atheist's right to believe what he chooses to believe and the Muslim's right to believe what he chooses to believe because God, my God, gave them that free will. Okay, but the new tolerance says, no, we can throw you in prison for hate speech and for hate beliefs, so I guess hate thoughts too. Death of Western civilization, Nietzsche said, if God is dead, then truth, morality, and meaning are dead as well. But this will produce the Superman, the next stage in the spiritual evolution of man, and then they'll create the new truth, the new morality, the new meaning. C.S. Lewis said, no. It's going to produce, 1940s, he said, it's going to produce the abolition of man with a few will control the billions, okay? And the man molders of the new age, his words, not mine, in the 1940s, rather prophetic, the man molders of the new age, the laws will be set up to defend them, to keep them in power, not to protect us. Francis Schaeffer, when responding to B.F. Skinner, referred to it as the death of man. So in other words, Lewis and Schaeffer saying, look, if God is dead, man is dead too. If we trash God and throw God off the bridge, man goes off the bridge as well. Nietzsche was more consistent than most atheists. Other atheists said, look, if we just read his The Madman Parable in his work, The Gay Science, which gay meant something different back then. But he said to his atheist colleagues, we threw God off the bridge and we were right to do that. But you guys were wrong when you went through his pockets and said, oh, traditional morality, we need that. Oh, absolute truth, got to have that. Oh, meaning in life, got to have that. Oh, right to life, we got to have that. Okay, now throw God off the bridge. Nietzsche's saying if God goes off the bridge, all those things go with him. But Nietzsche was inconsistent. He said this is going to bring about the Superman. No, it's going to bring about the death of man. If God is dead, man is dead too. So thanks to Darwinian evolution, a world without God has produced sexual promiscuity, both heterosexual and homosexual, loss of respect for human life and rights, abortion, I think we're up at about 50 million now in America, infanticide, euthanasia, genocide, and then even democide, death by government. Possible future, we're talking human cloning, genetic engineering, designer babies. You want a LeBron James, we might be able to pull that off. A master race, animal-human hybrids. Who knows? All I know is that every one of these things are being spoken about, although they'll never call a master race a master race. They'll just talk about perfect humans or superior people or more able people. So all I'm basically saying is if we reject God as a culture, there are consequences and moral implications of that. And Nietzsche could say God is dead, but I agree with Joshua. It's for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. God bless you.